The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. To stretch just a little bit what Donald Trump has already said, if the president shot John Bolton in the middle of Fifth Avenue, it seems he wouldn't lose any voters. Not among the Republican senators voting in his impeachment trial anyway. And by the time you're hearing this, it may be over, all but the shouting. And just as the president's lawyers have said already, it's finally going to be up to the voters to decide the fate of Donald Trump and the fate of the Republicans who have supported him all the way.
Hey, guys, let him through.
What do you make of John Bolton's motivations at this point? Do you think he's trustworthy?
Just half-assed in the House. I've seen the New York Times story. I have no idea what they're talking about.
I think there's no need for witnesses. I think the case, as I said, is so strong. Hopefully it's over this week, and we can get focused on doing the business of the American people.
So far as I know, there has been no witness deal.
Senator, are you in conversations about a bipartisan deal?
No.
The Democrats have spent a lot of time imagining what the president's motives are. Someone ought to spend some time imagining what John Bolton's motives are other than making millions of dollars to trash the president.
I will vote for a motion that allows for all relevant witnesses, and I think both sides are entitled to relevant witnesses. I do not see how Biden is relevant to these allegations, but I believe the standard is they have to be relevant.
We heard Senators Lindsey Graham, Jim Jordan, Lisa Murkowski, Mitt Romney, Rand Paul, and Kirsten Gillibrand. All of our coverage on impeachment is at NewYorker.com, much of it from Susan Glasser, who reports from the Capitol.
I see Carl Hulse there, the very distinguished New York Times correspondent.
I actually heard something funny today from staff. They're kind of enjoying this because their members are locked in the Senate without their phones for like all day, and they know where they are and don't have to talk to them.
We are on our way to hook up with Senator Chris Coons of Delaware. We're going to walk over from his Senate office to the Capitol for yet another day of proceedings in the Senate trial. It's Wednesday, right in the middle of the Senate trial of President Trump.
Hey, how are you?
Hi.
Hey.
Thanks so much. Hi there.
Sorry,
I hear the
I was just reflecting
protests,
on the fact
yeah.
that if we walk from here
right.
over to there, we're going to walk right through the
right,
middle of protests.
Right. When we walked over here before, I don't know if there's a huge number of people who come out, but when there weren't like a ton of people, so. Which is one of the notable things really about this impeachment trial. I've been really struck by the fact that there aren't, you know, people in the streets. So.
We had extra people lined up to answer the front desk calls because you know, during Kavanaugh, during the strike on Soleimani, during other moments in the last year or two, we've gotten just floods of phone calls.
Yeah.
We haven't. We've gotten hundreds, but not thousands.
The fact that they feel that they know the outcome is really the thing. Not that there aren't strong passions on both sides, but I know what's going
to
happen.
It's like watching a game that you've recorded and intend to watch, but then someone blurts out who won and what the score was, and you decide not to go back and just watch the replay.
What I wonder is about, you know, we're about to have the Iowa caucuses in New Hampshire, we're in an election year. You know, President Trump has essentially always appealed to people on the idea that this is a rigged process and a rigged system. In the Democratic Party, arguably, Bernie Sanders says something of the same. The system is rigged against you. This is literally kind of like a rigged trial. I don't know how that resounds politically, but I've been thinking a lot about that.
Well, if what ends up happening after 2 days of questioning is that every one of my Republican colleagues votes for no more witnesses, no more documents, it'll be hard to reach any other conclusion than they just didn't want to know, because John Bolton is available, is offering to testify, is, if press accounts are to be believed, the author of a finished manuscript that is directly relevant to the issues in front of the Senate. It's pretty hard to explain why you wouldn't want to hear from John Bolton.
So, okay, you're sitting there every day. I'm stuck up in the gallery, so I'm staring at you. You haven't been
I'll
a milk
drinker. I'll wave next time I see you.
You're not a milk drinker, apparently. Mitt Romney's a chocolate milk drinker. You're sitting there next to Amy Klobuchar, who, of course, is one of several Democratic senators running for president and who are stuck here in Washington instead of in Iowa. You're a big Biden backer coming from Delaware. You guys are passing notes. What are you talking about?
So, Amy, Senator Klobuchar also sits next to me on the Judiciary Committee. You know, partly they're just lighthearted notes, observations about particular members of the president's team or the House managers and how they're doing or what's going on. And sometimes I'm just encouraging her because I know it's difficult to be literally days away from the most important political moment of her life, which is the Iowa caucuses, and to be here rather than there.
It's really every time. We're now arriving at the Capitol, so we'll have a
brief in the main steps.
Security interlude. At least for us,
non-senators.
So now we're inside the Capitol with Senator Coons, and me and Senator Cantwell has just come in for the day, too. You have party lunches before...
Yes, we have a caucus lunch that's beginning right now.
Okay. And how useful are those for, you know, touching base with people and, you know, like, are you talking about
the trial? We're talking about the trial. We're sort of comparing notes on conversations we're having with colleagues. Today, in particular, we're having conversations about what are the questions that we're going to be asking, in what order, who's taking the lead on which issues.
Right. So what is your question that you most want answered?
Well, I've got 10 that I'd most like
to
be able to
ask. They're
not
going to let you ask 10.
Here's the question. The president's brief states, Congress has forbidden foreigners' involvement in American elections.
No, the other.
Despite that, in June 2019, President Trump said, if Russia or China offered information on his opponent, quote, there's nothing wrong with listening. And he said he might not even alert the FBI. Does President Trump agree with your statement, and again, this is a question to his lawyers, that foreigners' involvement in American elections is illegal?
Good question.
Let me put it this way. If the answer is no, we have a big problem. If there are Republicans who refuse to accept this foundational legal principle, heaven help us, and I'm assuming that those who end up voting against removal because of these impeachment articles will still agree that what the president did was wrong.
Well, that's the interesting thing. I would say that the Alan Dershowitz argument on Monday night for the Republican senators was key, because he essentially gave them the free pass to make the argument that you and I anticipated all along.
It was designed to give them a hook to hang their hat on that says, yes, what the president did was wrong, but you can't impeach him for that. I would say this. If your argument, if a Republican makes the argument, removing the president this soon, this close to an election, isn't the right response. We should trust the American electorate.
Yeah.
Let them make the decision.
That's another strong argument.
Then you have to support more witnesses and more documents, because otherwise you're saying, I trust the electorate, but I'm willing to participate in a cover-up that prevents them from knowing what they should know to reach a conclusion about this.
So, Senator Kuntz, you've been very generous with your time today.
It's always good
to see smell you. The lunch wafting out, although it doesn't smell that good. Is the food been okay?
I'll tell you, the food here is usually really good, but you know, not always.
Well, thank you again, Senator Kuntz, for your time.
Thanks, Susan. Great to be on with you.
Thank you. Okay, so we've just finished having a conversation with Senator Chris Coons of Delaware, and now we're going to walk through the Capitol to the Capitol Crypt and the hideaway office of Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren, who's one of the seven House managers. I'm here with Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren from California, who has the very interesting distinction of being not only one of the seven House managers prosecuting, in effect, the case against President Trump, but she is the only member who has been on her third impeachment. So we can talk a little bit about that. Congresswoman Nixon, Clinton, Trump. As Nancy Pelosi said, no matter what happens in the Senate, Donald Trump is always going to be impeached. That list is always going to include him.
That's right.
What's the shorthand you have in your head so far about the difference between Nixon, Clinton, and Trump?
Well, there are some surprising similarities between Nixon and Trump. Nixon tried to cheat in an election and he covered it up. Trump tried to cheat in an election and covered it up. The differences are, honestly, Nixon was more forthcoming with the Congress. He told publicly all his staff to come to the Congress to answer relevant questions honestly, without requiring a subpoena or anything of that nature. Trump told every member of the executive branch not to testify, no documents, nothing. Most people don't realize that Nixon was less of a cover-up artist than President Trump.
Amazing. We are speaking on Wednesday morning before the trial goes into session. And, of course, the big question is whether there's really anything other than a completely orchestrated kind of march to the inevitable outcome that we're witnessing. So what is your view of that?
Well, I'm an optimist. I don't think I could have this job if I weren't an
optimist.
You
have to be one.
And we have presented a very compelling case based on evidence and fact witnesses. In the trial, senators have a chance to call additional witnesses, and there has never been a trial in the Senate on impeachment, and it's not just presidential impeachment, it's judicial as well, where there haven't been witnesses and documents. So if the Senate declines to have documents and witnesses, that would be a radical departure from history and from precedent. It would also defeat the purposes I think they have, which is to find the truth. Ultimately, that's what a trial is about, to find the truth.
Well, of course, Congresswoman, right in the middle of the trial over a weekend on a Sunday late in the afternoon is when the news about John Bolton dropped in the New York Times. Where were you when you heard about it, and what did you think?
I was sitting with the other managers in a room in the Capitol going through the next day's proceedings and preparing, and one of the staff got a flash on their phone, and the first words out of my mouth were, yikes.
So you had no advance notice, no warning?
No, I had no idea. Now, we had heard, we'd read in the paper that there was some book, but what it said, we had no idea. I just thought, wow, I mean, that is a game changer. That's like when Nixon admitted everything Monday morning and he had to announce his resignation the next day. Wow.
But it wasn't. It's more like Access Hollywood, isn't it?
You know, that was about sex. Just like the Clinton impeachment was about sex. I don't approve of what Clinton did, and I certainly don't approve of the language and the behavior that President Trump engaged in. But that's not a high crime and misdemeanor. That's for voters to decide. And they decided that they didn't care about that misbehavior of President Trump. This is a very different issue. But this is not about misusing his power to subvert the Constitution of the United States to the detriment of the interests of the American people. That is a very severe charge.
I think that's what's so extraordinary for me, just as an observer, to watch what happens from that yikes, wow moment on Sunday evening. Over the last few days, you and I have both been in the Capitol, and we've heard a process once again of many of your Republican colleagues in the Senate essentially going from, wow, I'm not sure, to, well, we don't really need to hear from that anyways. And
some of the senators have said that. Let's be clear. Most of the senators haven't said anything. So we don't know what they're thinking. And I'd like to believe this, that they are evaluating what is the right thing for the country. That's what I'd like to believe they're doing.
For you, during the House manager's presentation last week, I was struck by the fact that you seemed to take a much more kind of evidence-based and legal approach to the presentation, and some of them were much more partisan and rhetorical. Was that by design on your part?
This is a trial. And so if they are laying out evidence that's incorrect or a theory of the law that doesn't hold up, then I think it's helpful, I hope, to the senators to point that out in a very logical way that gives citations to actual facts and law that they can use it as they reach a conclusion. And that's a job I was assigned to do, and I'm trying to do it best I can.
So, okay, on the arguments, what do you think is the strongest and weakest part of your case constitutionally?
I think there's clear evidence that the president committed a high crime and misdemeanor. He subverted the constitutional order for his personal benefit to the detriment of the interests of the country. I think there's no evidence of the contrary.
Are there any arguments that you heard from the Trump team so far that you thought were particularly strong or that you were surprised by?
You know, it's just dust in the air. I was really disappointed that it was, I thought, very weak.
Isn't the lesson here for American politics that stonewalling works?
If the Senate allows it, it will forever change the relationship between the branches of government. What it would say to a president, Democrat or Republican, you can just tell the Congress to pound sand. If this misbehavior is basically just ignored, I think what it means is there would not be a capacity for the Congress to utilize the remedy that the founders put in the Constitution to hold an executive to account, because there will never be a piece of information or a witness ever sent to Congress for an impeachment and probably for oversight either, for anything the president doesn't want.
Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren, I really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Susan Glasser is The New Yorker's Washington correspondent, and you can read her on impeachment and much more at newyorker.com. Zoe Lofgren represents the 19th Congressional District of California. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
In the 1930s, you could count on the Yankees winning the World Series, dust storms plaguing the prairies, evangelicals preaching on the radio, Franklin Delano Roosevelt residing in the White House, people lining up for blocks for scraps of food, and democracies dying from the Andes to the Urals to the Alps.
Jill Lepore is a historian at Harvard University and a staff writer at The New Yorker. And she's cultivated a real specialty in setting today's political upheavals in the context of American history. Her essay, In Every Dark Hour, considers how our nation responded the last time it seemed that democracy was in serious trouble around the world.
American democracy, too, staggered, weakened by corruption, monopoly, apathy, inequality, political violence, hucksterism, racial injustice, unemployment, even starvation. We do not distrust the future of essential democracy, FDR said in his first inaugural address, telling Americans that the only thing they had to fear was fear itself. But there was more to be afraid of, including Americans' own declining faith in self-government. What does democracy mean? NBC Radio asked listeners. Do we Negroes believe in democracy? W.E.B. Du Bois asked the readers of his newspaper column. Could it happen here? Sinclair Lewis asked in 1935. Americans suffered and hungered and wondered.
Jill, in your essay, you're describing a time when Americans and people all over the world were really questioning the future of democracy. What was going on that was making Americans so nervous, a familiar feeling, but so nervous about the democratic process?
It was witnessing new democracies fail. So at the end of the First World War, a whole lot of new democracies had been born when European empires had been broken up. And it was exciting and riveting, and there was a sense of triumph, that early 20s sense of triumph that markets were soaring, people were getting wealthier, democracies were thriving, and it all seemed to fall apart. And by the time you get to the 1930s, the beginning of the Depression, of course, it's much worse and much more perilous because the staggering needs of mass society seemed in many parts of the world to just be not addressable by majority rule, that there needed to be a strongman who could rescue starving populations from their suffering.
So this was a period of enormous uncertainty for democracy, and Americans themselves had a lot of questions about what democracy meant and how it should work. And the solution, you suggest to some extent, was to talk.
Yeah. I mean, on the one hand, a lot of Americans were swayed by communism and by fascism. I mean, there's a huge range of political opinion and all kinds of new political activity in the United States in the 1930s, political experiments. But in many ways, in response to the attractions of forms of political extremism, Americans who did believe in democracy really fought for it by trying to rekindle its spirit.
Well, I want to play a clip from something called America's Town Meeting of the Year.
What does democracy mean?
This is this completely goofy. I mean, I think I just sort of warn listeners. This sounds really corny. So you either love this stuff or you don't love this stuff. It was a national radio broadcast. It started in 1935, and it was enormously successful. So they would hold these debates in a lecture hall. They'd bring in like 1,000 people, sometimes more, and they'd bring to the stage a few different people, a panel of maybe 4 or 5 people. It wasn't like a one-on-one debate. I mean, they called it a debate. It's more of a panel or a symposium. And they'd have these big questions, should the United States have universal health insurance? And they'd bring in half the people on the panel would agree and half would disagree.
No more appropriate place could be found for a discussion of the subject, what does democracy mean, than our own town hall in New York City, the home of America's town...
In the early American town meetings, a majority of all citizens of a community used to meet together and determine where to build the new schoolhouse, how to run the new road, and what to do about Widow Jenkins' obstreperous cow. Is it possible to conceive of self-government today in those terms? What then does democracy mean under present conditions?
In that sense, democracy for the first time is really being tried. Democracy for the first time is really being tested.
Now for the questions. We'll take the man in the balcony there.
Mr. Hathaway stated that the democracy he expects is the democracy that will permit this present capitalist class to bring in socialism peacefully. Don't you think that the working class, Mr. Hathaway, would do very well to drop any nonsense of any possibility of bettering its condition under this present system of society and listen to the message of the Socialist Labor Party, the only revolutionary organization in the United States?
What I'm struck by listening to it is like the sense that people had in the 1930s that they were really on the precipice of a history, that democracy was new, as that announcer said. Like, historically, democracies had only begun with the United States in 1776, and but what they really do accomplish a lot of these conversations is really bringing in ordinary people. I mean, you just really do get the sense when you listen to them or when you read debates, accounts of debates that are going on in, town libraries and in school buildings that are opened up at night for debates, political debates, that, you're kind of basic farmers there, your union worker is there, then, the nurse from the hospital is there, the librarian is there. And people are really kind of dedicating themselves, kind of struggling with working their way through these really big questions. I mean, think about the suffering of the Depression. I mean, everyone was vulnerable to complete economic collapse. No matter where you stood, you could fall really fast, and people saw one another falling really fast. And so what was going to hold people up? Well, you were going to have to hold each other up.
Jill, I understand you want to play another clip, which might be more familiar to our listeners.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News. At 20 minutes before 8 Central Time, Professor Farrell of the Mount Jennings Observatory, Chicago, Illinois, reports observing several explosions of incandescent gas occurring at regular intervals on the planet Mars. The spectroscope indicates the gas to be hydrogen and moving toward the Earth with enormous velocity. Professor Pearson of the observatory at Princeton confirms Farrell's observation and describes the phenomenon as, quote, like a jet of blue flame shot from a gun, unquote.
Well, I think some people at least will recognize that this is a clip from Orson Welles' famous apocalyptic radio drama, The War of the Worlds. But I've got to say, it's not the direction I thought we were heading in. How does this relate to discussions about democracy that were going on at that time?
It was totally just a pretext to listen to Orson Welles. No. So War of the Worlds was broadcast, of course, on Halloween in 1938. And Welles has offered many explanations over his lifetime for why he did it. But the one I believe, and I choose to believe, is that Welles was actually genuinely concerned about the possibilities that radio could be used for nefarious purposes. That if you think about what the implications are of a technology of communications, radio is invasive. Like it's this voice in your kitchen coming out of your living room. It's incredibly intimate, and the term fake news comes out of the 1930s because it's what Americans and the British, what's what the Allies called Nazi radio broadcasts on shortwave radio. They broadcast these English language news reports. They were just a bunch of lies. They broadcast them all over North and South America. And there was a lot of stuff on the radio. There was Father Coughlin. There's a lot of nuttiness from Huey Long. There's a lot of stuff that you should be really suspicious of on the radio. And Wells was kind of interested in saying, here's actually another obligation of living in a democracy. You have to actually be careful where you're getting your information. You have to have a critical apparatus around it.
And that's a lesson we're still struggling with, it seems. Jill, one thing that surprises me, you wrote about the Democracy Index, which rates the nations of the world on just how democratic they are, right down to the bottom of the list where North Korea is. But the U.S. isn't doing so great in recent years. Why not? What are the factors that go into a country's rating in the Democracy Index?
Yeah, it's this, I mean, you can, I guess people try to measure anything. And there was a kind of concern. This Democracy Index was started by a think tank, I think, associated with The Economist magazine, as an expression of concern for the seeming fragility of democracies around the world, that would be something that would be worth paying attention to. So there's a whole series of measures that go into it, having to do with voter turnout or having to do with do people show up, even kind of congressional turnout, legislative turnout. Are laws being passed or are laws being vetoed? How is the press free? Is there censorship? And unsurprisingly, when the Democracy Index started, the United States was one of the stronger democracies, rated as a full democracy. According to this index, the United States first fell out of that top tier category in 2016 and became a flawed democracy. And every year since 2016, the U.S. rating has been worse. So two things seem to be true from this evidence, right? That the number of democracies around the world has been dwindling. And then in the case of the United States has become significantly less democratic.
So we chalk that off to Donald Trump. What are the factors that have made us dip?
I guess I just think that stuff that's been going on with the growing power of the presidency as against the other branches of government goes pretty far back. I mean, it certainly goes back to Nixon.
That's for sure.
I can't see a Hillary Clinton White House having turned that around and ceded power back to Congress, for instance. The increasing politicization of the Supreme Court is something that, I mean, I would date to really Reagan's Justice Department and Reagan's appointments. I guess conservatives would look at that differently, but you know, people would date that to the Warren Court, say. Those are things that are making our system of government not work as it was designed.
And increasing income inequality, which precedes Trump, and it's just only been exacerbated, but it's not all on him. I take your point completely. It just seems that since 2016, in rhetoric and in action, the individual has made a difference. I'm not saying he's the everything and the be-all, and there weren't factors before, and it will probably outlive him.
Outlive him. But, I mean, I don't know. I put a chart on the screen in a class that has income inequality, polarization charted from 1945 to 2016, and we get where we get based on changes that start in 1968. So, yes, you can follow that chart from 2016 to 2020, and things look worse. But it's a long-term, those are long-term trends.
Your piece fairly yearns for, calls for the modern equivalent somehow of town halls, radio plays, public forums, the kind of thing we were discussing before. How would you see that taking place in the world that you know of, the university, of social media, of the technologies that we have available? Is it even possible? What would it look like?
I'm sure that it actually does take place in all kinds of ways. I mean, I spend a fair amount of time going to K-12 schools and meeting with kids and watching them debate stuff or argue over things. I think there's a lot more of that going on than we might perceive. I don't think you can really track it going on social media because it's just not conducive. It's not conducive as a format to the kind of careful, deliberative listening that you can imagine. But I think it actually goes on all the time in classrooms. Like I went to my city council, to a city council meeting this year, and I was like, all right, democracy is still working. But you kind of have to get into a room with people.
So I want to go back to your piece. You write about a series that ran in 1937 in the New Republic, where editors asked each writer, a series of writers, whether they thought political democracy was on the wane, and you described the answer given by the Italian philosopher Benedetto Croce. And Italy at that point was living under fascism. So what did Croce say?
He objected to the question the way a good philosopher should. And he just objected to the passive framing of the question, because he's like, his thing was, all right, politics and government is not like the weather. Like, we don't just, like, you're asking me basically a meteorological question, like, what's the weather look like? It's not the weather. We control politics and government. So you don't ask people, what's the weather going to be like? You ask people, go out and, how are you going to go out and change the weather? What are you going to do? You don't just sit around, like, trying to decide, do I need an umbrella today? You actually go out and change the weather. And that's what I think people had a sense of needing to urgently do in the 1930s. And we do have a kind of different sensibility, I don't know, in the quarters that I inhabit. There's a lot of political despair. It's a fashionable political despair. It's almost like a fetish for political despair.
Is it a reasonable political despair?
Seriously? No, I don't actually think it is. I really don't. Because, look, before 1965, we didn't even have voting rights in this country. Like, what is the past that you think was so infinitely better than this moment? It's easy to take democracy for granted when things are going fairly well. And when you watch democratic institutions being jeopardized, and when you watch abuses of power and authority, it casts your attention and your concern into really stark light. And those conversations that you have about what's going on are what actually restores the democracy. They are what rekindles those traditions, what defends those institutions, and what renews the democracy itself.
Jill Lepore, thanks so much.
Thanks, David.
Jill Lepore is a staff writer. Now, throughout this election year, we're going to be considering the future of democracy from a range of perspectives, and we've inaugurated a series appropriately called The Future of Democracy. And we'll send you all the pieces in the series if you text the word democracy to the number 70101. Don't worry, I tried it and it works. Text the word democracy to 70101. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
When was the last time you walked on the Williamsburg Bridge?
Not much. I don't live here anymore, and I never really need to go over to Delancey anymore. Every so often I do it just for, like, old time's sake, but it's not the same bridge anymore, you know? You know, it no longer has holes in it. You know, back in the day when they had basically let most of New York's infrastructure just kind of rot, literally it had holes in it, like foot wide and so forth, through the pedestrian path.
N.K. Jemisin is one of the most decorated authors in science fiction today. Jemisin won a Hugo Award for each of the novels in her Broken Earth trilogy, which is sort of like winning the Oscar for Best Picture 3 years in a row. Jemisin has a new book coming out in March, and she met up recently with Rafi Khachdourian, a staff writer for The New Yorker.
A few weeks ago, we met on the Williamsburg Bridge because her newest novel, The City We Became, has an important scene here. So, Nora, mm-hmm. In the opening of your forthcoming book, you have set upon this bridge
a giant tentacled bioluminescent interdimensional creature to tear it apart.
Basically, yeah. Well, I mean, no one can see it except for a few select individuals for reasons that will become clear in the book. But, you know, it just sort of is a giant tentacle that smashes out of nowhere, shatters half the bridge, causes massive destruction and damage all over the East River. And no one really knows why except for a few people. But what it means is that half this beautiful old bridge gets torn apart and smashed into the water, and I laughed while I did it.
We ducked into a bar on the Brooklyn side of the bridge to talk out of the wind. Science fiction is transporting, it's whimsical, it can go in many different directions, it can be apocalyptic. Mm-hmm. To say that you were interested in science fiction opens up the question, what kind as a kid interested you, and in which of these directions did you feel yourself being pulled as a reader?
I really didn't start to engage with science fiction until I kind of hit my teens and started to find different voices out there. Octavia Butler, Ursula Le Guin, stories that also ranged beyond the very traditional confines that I had seen for fantasy and science fiction at that point. And I wanted to kind of know what else fantasy could do. And then along comes Le Guin, who was doing it before it was cool.
You mentioned that it took a while to find some of these other authors. Mm-hmm. And my understanding is that wasn't accidental. Mm. Because science fiction publishing in the when you were a reader as a kid in the 80s almost went out of its way to mask the identity of writers of color. Octavia Butler's Dawn is an example of a book that we both owned.
The protagonist is described in the book as a tall, very dark-skinned black woman with like a cloud of hair. And I don't think Butler ever actually uses the word black, but there's so many other indicators in there. And then the edition put a white woman with black hair on the cover. And there were no author photos of Butler. There was no mention in her bio in that edition that she was black. It really was like hidden. And yet, despite all the attempts to hide it, I realized basically within the first few pages, oh my God, I think she's black. And that was just like earth-shattering.
Mm-hmm. This cultural invisibility that the system of publishing engendered had a personal impact on you, because when you were, as I understand it, growing up and thinking about considering possible careers for yourself,
I didn't initially consider writing.
You didn't consider writing. You didn't think it would be possible to make it work.
I mean, and that was coming from a lot of different directions. I don't want to make it sound like it was coming strictly from within the industry. You know, I can remember having conversations with relatives other than my father about the fact that I love to write, and, you know, them then handing me a Toni Morrison book and saying, do you write like this? And when I said no, you know, the response was always, well, you need to write like this. You need to write realist, mainstream-oriented fiction that will, you know, kind of focus on life in America today as a black person, or oppression, or something like that. And I was just like, but I want to write about black people in space. You know, and for a lot of times when I would say that, the response would be, well, you can't.
And why in the black community do you think that was the case?
Well, I mean, it is the nature of any group of people that you understand you are capable of what you see. Role models operate on lots of levels. If you never see a black person in a particular space, then you get the really clear message that you're not welcome in that space. And so I got that message loud and clear when I was young. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to be a counselor. I'm going to grad school for psychology. You know, the writing is a fun hobby, but it's clear that that field is not one that I can be successful in without, you know, a lot of trouble and drama and stress. And I don't know that I want that in my life. And then, you know, basically I hit a point where I realized I was just not happy. You know, the writing bug had been in me since I was a child. I'd always done it. I'd read many books that had been published that I felt, you know, I can do that. I can do at least that good. And, you know, I hit a point where I decided that it was worth the danger or worth the trouble and the stress and the drama. And it sure has been some trouble and stress and drama. But, you know, the rewards have been commensurate.
When Jemison talks about the trouble and the stress and the drama, she's partly referring to a backlash from conservative science fiction writers and readers, among them people associated with the alt-right. They claim, and this will sound familiar, that the success of non-white authors and women in science fiction has somehow been undeserving, a form of identity politics. It's been very, very ugly, and Jemison's new book, The City We Became, addresses the legacy of racism in the genre.
And in fact, the book that's coming out in March continues to speak to those issues.
In some ways. So one of the inspirations for The City We Became was the controversy surrounding the World Fantasy Award. Until maybe 2 or 3 years ago, the World Fantasy Award was the stylized bust of H.P. Lovecraft's head. And the controversy about this started when a black writer, Nnedi Okorafor, who's a friend of mine, Nnedi won the World Fantasy Award, and they handed her Lovecraft's head, and she was like, you can find her words online about it. She did, she most definitely pointed out that Lovecraft is an inappropriate way to honor a black writer's success, let's just say.
Nora, who is H.P. Lovecraft?
Okay, so Lovecraft is probably one of the most seminal writers in American modern fantasy. You know, he wrote at the turn of the century, but a lot of the ways in which American fantasy and American horror engages with subcultures, cults, religion, and so forth were all influenced by Lovecraft. So you saw, you know, sort of sinister cults that had taken over towns, and there's echoes of that in The Stepford Wives, for example. You saw tentacled monsters that sort of didn't come at you roaring or screaming, but sort of slithered into your life and integrated themselves into your community and then slowly destroyed you from within. You see aspects of that in things like Aliens, you know, in the Alien films. So, you know, Lovecraft may not be very well known, but you see elements of Lovecraft in nearly all dark, fantastical American media these days. So he's that influential. And he was exceptionally racist. Lovecraft had a poem, and I cannot speak the title because I don't use the N-word, but the title of the poem is On the Creation of N-Words. And his cat was named the N-word. He was like, even by the standards of the racist era in which he lived, he was huge, hella racist.
But and do you think that there is a way to separate whatever his creativity, whatever his skills were at evoking horror from his fear, from his biases?
No, his biases were the basis of his horror. The monsters came from his own fear of brown people, of immigrants, of Jewish people, of whatever. In several of his stories, particularly one set in New York, Lovecraft spends a lot of time, sort of lavishes description on how terrifying it is to do something like walk through Chinatown and look at these alien, frightening faces speaking in this terrible language. And you feel his fear as you read these passages. You feel his disgust. You feel his unease at being surrounded by people who don't look like him. There's a scene in The City We Became in which the minions of the woman in white...
the woman in white being the chief manifestation of these aliens that come to invade New York City.
Yeah,
and in effect, the embodiment of the Lovecraftian enemy, let's say, that the protagonists are taking on.
Yeah, the antagonist of the story. The woman in white has many forms and many faces. And one of the ways through which she works is through like-minded people who she infects with her ideology, literally in some ways, some cases. And so she infects a group of artists who call themselves the alt-artists, mm-hmm. And who present to one of the characters this painting called Dangerous Mental Machines. And the painting...
You didn't make up the title of that painting. That's something that comes from Lovecraft.
Yeah, Dangerous Mental Machines is what he called Chinese Americans because he believed that Asian people were equivalent to white people because they at least knew how to work and make money. But he didn't think that they had souls. He thought that they were machines that were good at calculation, but there was no humanity in there.
And Nora, I remember this passage of the book. Mm-hmm. It's vivid in my mind because you describe the painting as both being incredibly seductive, mm-hmm. of it being beautiful. In fact, one of the chief protagonists almost falls into a trance, mm-hmm. while looking at it.
It's good art.
It's good art, even though it has this undeniably horrific component to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's you know, I mean, I'm not good at sort of analyzing my own work, but with Lovecraft, the balance and the struggle is always between appreciating the fact that there's some good stuff here. He does some incredible imagery. It's powerful work, but it's frightening. And it's frightening not always for the reasons that he meant it to be frightening. It's frightening because it's a way to look into the mind of a true bigot and realize just how alien their thinking is, just how disturbing their ability to dehumanize their fellow human beings is. This man literally saw the people of New York as monsters. So that's what I decided to write against.
And so what do you think as a society or community of readers, the response to Lovecraft should be today? To put it in a box and send it down to the bottom of the sea?
No. There's too much to learn from examining that tension between the power and the impact of the art and realizing where that art comes from and what the impetus behind that art is. The best way to engage with twisted or otherwise problematic art, in my opinion, is to first off acknowledge that art has an impact, hurts people, and understand that engaging with it could perpetuate some of the harm that art is capable of doing. But flag it, warn it, put it off to the side where people, you know, can engage with it at their leisure or at their choice or at a point where they're strong enough or capable of doing so, but then engage with it. Mm-hmm. There's a line between respecting the work and honoring the person. You can respect the craft. You don't have to put that person on a pedestal. Mm-hmm. You know, artists are human beings, and that means you need to examine them in all their facets. You have to recognize that these are people and that the things that make them sometimes horrible people are sometimes the things that make them good writers or good artists. And that's what you want to engage with.
N.K. Jemisin, author of the Broken Earth trilogy. All three books received the Hugo Award. She talked with Rafi Khachaturian, a staff writer, since 2008. I'm David Remnick, and thanks for joining us today, and I hope you'll tune into the New Yorker Radio Hour next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of TuneYards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Karen Frillman, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Morgan Flannery, Allison McAdam, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.